Welcome back to the Teaching in Tech podcast, where we continue to explore everything related to teaching, learning, and technology integration. Working with teachers, we see amazing things happening in classrooms every day. In each episode, we'll detail teaching strategies and technology integration ideas that are working. Also, special guests will join us to share strategies that have been successful with students. All right, so we are back for another episode of Teaching in Tech with Alan and Chad. And our guest for this month's episode from Canton City Schools is Paul Donatelli. Welcome to Teaching in Tech.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you today, Chad. Paul, sorry.
Fine.
Don't worry, Alan. I'm glad to be here, Chad, as well.
Glad to have you as well.
All right. So, Paul, right now you're teaching computer science at our Timken campus. And why don't you just give us a little bit of an idea of how you ended up in this position? I know you've had a few different roles over the years with Canton City Schools and even some places that you've taught before coming to Canton. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up in this computer science position.
I'll start kind of recently. Since I've been in Canton, I've been developed into very much a jack of all trades. And so I found myself teaching computer science now. I came in the door teaching math. When some engineering classes opened up, I started teaching those. And at one point, it even taught a class that was a sheltered ELL, almost entirely Hispanic class with very little English speaking, Algebra 1. And so I've done a variety here. But going way back, I went to school to be an engineer, graduated from Akron with a mechanical engineering degree. I worked as a manufacturing engineer for a company called Gojo, which locally a lot of people are aware of. So from there, some unique circumstances, I didn't really want to continue doing that. I wanted to pursue some other, I guess, personal options in life. And I went back to grad school with what probably was the easiest thing I could pursue, which was exercise physiology. So I have a master's degree in exercise physiology, which was in the Department of Education at the University of Akron. So I also have a master's in education from that. While I was there, my grad assistantship kind of evaporated, so I had to find other options. I started teaching math in their developmental programs department. Those were remedial classes for students in college. They were non-credit. I mean, as low as things like learning how to round and solve one-step
like real
equations.
Real intro type stuff.
Very much intro, yeah. That was, in a way, a sad scenario because students would be taking these 4-credit classes, which cost a lot of money. And if you're starting off in basic math 1, you were typically about 3-4 credit classes away from taking a credit math class, depending on your major.
Oh, wow.
So that's 12 credit hours you're going to go through before you ever get to the point of taking something that's really going to count. So there was a little bit of bitterness among the students in those classes, but there was also a lot of need. Fast forward, I worked my way into alternative school and taught math there for a year. I taught at St. Vincent St. Mary during like LeBron James's senior year. I actually had him in class.
Oh, wow.
That is really interesting. Cool. I did not know that. I mean, that's probably one of the more, you'd have to say globally, one of the more well-known people from Northeast Ohio.
Yeah,
and
right,
to have him as a student, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And he was actually a really nice guy, really smart too. It was an interesting year from a standpoint of being a student in the school. I don't know that it was the greatest thing ever for all of the class that was there.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think he went out of his way to make it bad for them. It's just the nature of being like so
he was.
So famous. Yeah, it just, but again, he was a good guy, actually quite smart. I enjoyed having him. So it was a good experience.
That's an interesting year. 1 year there, and that's what.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the other thing I was thinking too that would make that, from your standpoint in academics, they did so much travel that year. I mean, playing almost like a national schedule. I mean, there were a lot of games they played out of Ohio, so that probably made it somewhat interesting for the players that were on the team, just as far as their academics and so forth.
So I'll be honest with you, that's over 20 years ago, and I don't remember those details. I can pinpoint
Dad wants
memorable
all the
things,
details.
Kind of funny stuff in class and things like that, but I don't recall that, to be honest with you, but it probably was very much an issue.
Well, actually I was coaching high school basketball at the time. So, you know, everyone was very aware of what was going on over there. And I was in Northwest Ohio, but the OHSAA actually, when his group finished and got through, they actually changed the rules, as to how much travel you could do and the amount of games you could,
it more or less just based on that very circumstance. So,
yeah, it's justified. I understand. Yeah. So, and then from there, I started teaching at Hoban, which is where I actually graduated high school. I had already been coaching there, and it just kind of became a natural transition over. And I taught pretty much everything up through AP calculus there. Did that for 9 years, decided I needed a break, went back into the manufacturing world, and I was a quality manager at a machine shop for a year. I would say that was not the most enjoyable job to take because I was screamed at from pretty much everybody, both inside the company and outside the company. Worked a lot of hours. And when the opportunity came for me to get back in the classroom, I jumped at it and I got hired at Timken. Taught math there for 2 years. When an engineering role came up, which was the same time as Timken and McKinley merged, they closed Timken. Mm-hmm. I started teaching intro to engineering. And then after one of our legendary teachers, Mr. Small, retired, I kind of took over some of his higher level classes. And then over the past few years, as we've been sort of like right-sizing what people are teaching, they opened up this computer science thing. And I don't have a development background where I'm writing apps for people, but I've programmed and done stuff for functional needs in my jobs. And so I felt comfortable enough to take this on, and here I am. So,
well, I have to say for of the guests that we've had on, and it's always very interesting to talk to people and find out a little bit about their path and their journey to get where they are today. But you definitely have a lot of different experiences there. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, teaching at the university level, teaching in a parochial environment, teaching in an urban environment like Canton City. All of them have, you know, differences, but at the same time, the similarity where you're working with students. Is there one of those environments that kind of stood out to you more than others, or one where you felt like your skills were best put to use?
I'm very happy here. It's no secret that urban schools struggle. Right. And because of that, the opportunities here are fantastic. Like, I don't have to sort of sit by and do exactly what someone else is doing because, well, it works. Well, if you have a large group of very compliant people, pretty much anything will work and you'll get success. Urban schools, that's not the situation. And so there's a lot of latitude to try different things. I consider it like an entrepreneurial kind of thing where mm-hmm. if it looks like you can make something work, and you might as well try it. I've never felt inhibited in that way since I've been here.
It's a good feeling to have when you have some ability to try some different things. And some of that, I think, probably ties in with your engineering skills too, to not just take things at face value, but look for better ways to do things and try to find a more efficient, more effective way to reach kids.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you've done a nice job. I mean, I've known you since the merger, Paul, and I think you've always done a nice job of taking your skills from outside the classroom and really applying it in. And I don't know that anybody that generally when you come from trade to the classroom, right, that's not always an easily transferable skill. And honestly, because of your work in the classroom, I wouldn't have guessed which came first, right?
Really?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think you do a great job of bridging it over and applying it and knowing you now, right? I know more of your background, except for the fact that, you know, you taught LeBron James and you've had more extensive history in manufacturing and engineering. But one thing that I thought has always been admirable of your work is you don't stop finding the best way to solve the problems. Right, which I think would come from your engineering, but your practice with kids is not necessarily something that you would have learned from a master's program.
No, especially not the one I went through. It was not designed to make me a professional educator. It comes down to the fact that I get bored very easily, and so like the statement I generally like to make is if you're a math teacher, you didn't spend 4 years in school so you could grade 600 quadratic formulas a night. It's a lot of time and a lot of money to do mm-hmm. very redundant things. And so it's much better for everybody involved if you find a more effective way to get through the tedious things. And so that's kind of my driving motivation. So,
no, it's interesting you say that because I think about my time teaching middle school science, and in that you have a lot of different people that take approaches to how they would teach a class like that. And to, like you said, to just do that repetitive thing, even if you're by the book, covering all your standards, going deep into the content and using good teaching strategies, if you're doing that year after year and the standards don't change, that's not a very creative, a very creative environment every day. And it really can kind of wear. And for me, about, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 years into teaching middle school science, I really started taking an interest in, you know, at the time it was STEM before they started kind of adding the arts and this, you know, the STEAM angle of it, and just trying to use some of those same kind of ideas of design challenges, design products, and how to get kids thinking a little bit about, you know, not just memorizing facts, not just preparing for tests, but how can we, and with the middle school, it was always a challenge too, just to be able to organize an environment where they could work on those design challenges in an orderly way where you felt like they were getting something out of it. So I can definitely see, you know, as you talk about that in a math setting, you want to avoid getting into that routine and that redundancy and be able to think things through and solve problems.
Yeah. And there's absolutely a place for it all. But at the same time, it's if my whole year is just give a load of homework every day or give a load
drill
of
and kill, right? Like just, if it's just drill and kill, I'm bored.
I can't handle that. And so if I can't handle it, I can't expect my students to do it. And I can't just find a faster way to get that evaluated for them either. It has to be a better way for them to learn, in my mind. So.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that anytime that I've had a chance to get to the downtown campus and interact with you and Chad with what the things you guys have going on, I do always come away impressed. And that's kind of part of the reason we were looking forward to having this conversation, just because I don't think everybody in our district realizes all the great things that you guys have going on down there. And with that being said, let's kind of move into some of the things that that you've had success with in working with students. You know, as you've mentioned, you've been in Canton City for quite a few years now. You know, what type of things have you been able to, whether it's, you know, ideas in theory or whether it's, you know, actual things that you're working through with students that you find to be successful?
Well, I'm going to start with something that I had been doing, like kind of in as I walk through the door, and it's not my idea, it's someone else's. I've just sort of tailored it to what I think are sound educational practices. I do these things called MSQs, or at least I formerly did. They would have a new name now, but MSQ stands for Math Skills Quiz. Typically, it's about 10 questions. They're given once a week. Could be something where it's maybe six times a quarter, but they're repetitive questions. I don't change the order. I don't change anything. They're typically review oriented. And so students are they're very aware of what's going to happen. It's very predictable. And what I typically do is offer them the option of their two highest scores counting, or when they get two perfect scores, they're done taking them for the quarter. So it's low risk. It's not a big time consumption in my class as far as like taking away from current material that should be addressed. And it's not something that they have to be really intimidated by. I mean, at first it may not look good in the grade book if they have like a 1 out of 10 and a 2 out of 10, but as time goes by, they can replace those with higher scores. Mm-hmm. Again, with the goal of saying, well, if I really put the effort into this, I can be done in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever it takes. That's probably the starting point for a lot of what I do. And I'm going to give credit to someone. I worked at Hoban, the department chair of math there, Rose Zaha. She would actually do something called a sink or swim. Same kind of idea. There was a slightly different take on how it would operate. And the only significant change that I've made in this is that I do the mastery style of it, where it's the best two count. But it's the same premise. It's just a constant review that goes on and on and on. And it's just a phenomenal way for you to kind of give people a chance to do stuff without consuming a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. I'm glad you brought the term up, mastery, because as you were describing the process, you know, that was the first thought that came to my mind. And you see a lot of that now with some of the digital things that we use, because it becomes really easy to keep cycling kids through like key concepts. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you've been doing this like well before that, where you kind of had your own version of that before it became really simple to just roll into a digital format.
Yeah, it's interesting how you can kind of arrive at something and then later discover that there's a word to describe it. You know, and I'm not suggesting that I've invented something. It's just the idea that sometimes it's just the you get a sense from the students that they need an alternative that's going to help them, and they need to feel as though it's helping them. And so that's kind of where I came to it.
I think I see the progress, right? And so I'll give you credit, Paul, because you know, you gave credit to somebody else, but I'm going to give you the credit because you showed me these and I actually used them, similar model, right? Set the goals and then kids, right, could see the progress week after week, but it allowed for that cyclical review in class.
Yeah.
Right. And then you see where their progress is, and it just, it was more intentional. And now it's funny. I look at, like, when we talk about AI and all these assessment resources with Wayground and anything like that, it's real easy to implement something like that that becomes almost scheduled. You don't even, like, yeah. I remember I collaborated with you on creating so many of them. Then you go print them and work through them. But
yeah. I mean, so here's the other thing. I mean, from a non-altruistic point of view or even non-professional point of view, the MSQs, I mean, once you create the first one for the quarter that you're going to do, it doesn't take any time to create the next one or the next one or the next one. It's just basically going in and changing some numbers, typically in math. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to talk about efficiency in that regard, because, I mean, I feel as though, like, we're pulled a lot of different directions. And so it's, how does this help me as a teacher? And this isn't a high demand thing for me to do. It's not high demand to grade it. It's nothing. It's all very fast. And so it's got the value is tremendous on a lot of different fronts. And so, again, I'm not afraid to say I want to be lazy at times, and this afforded me the opportunity to be lazy, but still be quite effective. So
I don't know about lazy. I mean, I think that's just smart, right? Yeah. When you've got time, and time is a valuable resource. You don't need to waste it by recreating something that's already been done.
Right.
And that's being effective.
I think I can understand the mindset too, because when you, as a teacher at times, I think we sometimes fall back on those kind of things just because they're, as you mentioned, they don't take a ton of brain power, and it's easy to mindlessly grade through 10 problems or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like you talked about in the efficiency, and this is really where my mind has gone with some of the new AI tools that have been introduced over the last couple of years. If we can think about how can we not only maximize, like, class time, but our workflow as educators,
yep.
and use these different processes so that, you mentioned the idea of wanting to work on more creative things and problem solving. We don't have to spend as much time on the clerical stuff, and we can be more involved in creative, you know, thinking, what type of lesson planning, student projects, all of it. And I think that's a huge win for teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to discount the fact that part of this was motivated by laziness. I mean, it's,
I tried to save you on that one.
I get it, but if you want to reach people, I think, talking to them where they are might be a good thing too. And there's a lot of people who are looking for options to be, to take the foot off the gas a little bit and still be effective. And, you know, it's a hard thing, and I can feel comfortable doing that. And I can sort of jokingly say I wanted to be lazy about it, but it saves me time, it saves me effort, and it's effective. So,
and I think that's the key part, right? Is that there was efficiency there, and you did see growth with the kids, and that became part of your system, right? Like, you kept that all year long with slight modification, and you saw growth with your students.
Yeah. I mean, the simple fact is, it's almost like you're doing test prep. You're doing it 9 weeks out of a half an hour a week, 9 weeks consecutively, where you're just hitting these things, and it's very planned and prescribed, and there's just enough pressure on them to deliver and to do what they have to do on it, where it's not just, well, we're talking about it in class, and if I pay attention or don't pay attention, it doesn't matter. It's
because there's still a weight to it.
Yeah.
I think that the other thing that the way you described it, students do thrive off of structure as well. So they know what to expect. They know how it's going to be involved, you know, in their grade. They know what it's a part of the week that they can, or maybe biweekly, however the time interval is. And so I think that helps students a lot too, as opposed to like a big high stakes stress type, you know, test where they say, well, I didn't prepare, so I'm just going to forget it. They're going to see this content enough times that either one, they're just going to get it through the repetition, or two, if they're struggling with it early on, they're going to get other opportunities to show that they've learned that. And I mean, at the end of the day, I think that's the idea for a teacher, being able to pick out what are the key points of knowledge and then find ways that you can really give kids enough experiences that in the end, they get those key ideas down. I think for new teachers, I know for me personally, that was an issue early on. I was so concerned about what my plans were going to look like every day, you know, week after week. And you really do got to be good at pulling out what are the real key topics. And we're going to have some things that are going to extend kids and take kids, you know, a little bit deeper. But what are the key topics they need to know, and how can I really give them the best opportunity to get there?
Yeah. There's so many things. And again, like it happened, organically, you know, you do this, you follow someone else's lead, and then you start to modify it to your own tastes. And, you arrive at this, and then I start meeting with David Anderson, along the way, who's, I would consider him like my mentor here, 'cause he just perpetually feeds me research that I can use and start to do more with. And you start to discover that there's a whole lot of research to support what you're doing, and then you can start fine-tuning what it is to a better level that utilizes that research fully, or the principles associated with it.
And putting it into practice.
Yeah. So, and you know, it's I'm just going to segue into the next part of this. He and David again had referred to it's called expectancy, value, and cost. And sort of how it's behavioral economics in a sense, and like why we choose to do the things we do. And so it took many, many, many months and many conversations for me to fully grasp this, but expectancy, like what is that? Like, and it took a while for me to grasp the word. Actually, let's step that back. It took me a while for me to not say it's expect, I was using a different word. At this point, I say it right every time, but I got the word right eventually, and then I started understanding what the word was, and then I started understanding that, like, my whole role as a teacher is to raise student expectancy. Do they expect to be successful after doing
of themselves?
Yeah. And so, like, is the work I'm putting in raising their expectancy of themselves?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, my greatest role in the classroom is to raise expectancy of my students. When they walk in and look at an assignment, do they say, "Oh, I can do this"? And they start making value judgments on it, or they say, "I'm not even going to bother because I don't think I can do it." And so understanding that and how to implement it really has transformed kind of how I plan from day to day, and sort of what resources I put in front of my students and the questions I ask and everything. I mean, I still struggle. I still make plenty of mistakes, but it's a guide that North Star, so to speak, that I kind of continually look back at and say, I got to kind of get back on task with this.
So.
Good. I was just saying, I talked to David quite a bit about behavioral economics and right, the building of expectancy in students. And I always found that approach very interesting. It was an interesting perspective. It doesn't change the idea or goal of what the teacher is doing in the classroom, but I think it puts it in a different perspective where when you're planning, you're becoming more intentional about the steps on not only how to get them engaged, right? But to then the ability to build the confidence in themselves to perform, but then maybe the next time perform better. And then perform better. And so his, like when I had talked with him, and I'm sure yours is, you know, I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you structure some of your lesson to do it. But his was essentially starting out with, let's just start with basic engagement and then extend to maybe by the end of the year to production. Right. And you're essentially that as that confidence builds, their expectancy of themselves builds. And so they produce more in the end.
So it's an interesting one because it starts to blend in with the other things I said. If you go back to the MSQs, it's
right.
The mastery idea fits in well with the expectancy part. Well, I don't get it today, but I've got time to get it.
I can still get it.
Yeah. And so like it's not, I'm not punished for not getting it today would be the other thing that goes with this. And so you kind of start there. You start to look at it from another point of view of David and I kind of go back and forth on this. And we're probably bickering over a 1% difference in what we're discussing.
probably.
He tends to believe, like, as a teacher, I don't really have the ability to raise a task's value for a student or something that we're learning's value. Like, I can do a little bit to nudge it. I can try and say the right thing. I kind of have a little bit more of a belief in my power to do that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how, like, I have a lot of control over the cost that the student, like, perceives in it. And so, again, going back to the mastery thing, the cost is temporary, so to speak. I mean, I might do poor on this one, but with time, I'm going to do better and better and better. But then you start getting into these finer things of what can I do as a teacher to enhance what they're doing. And so you've probably seen him do the micro teaches. Chad, I don't know if you've been to them, Alan. I know you have.
Yeah.
And all you're doing is just doing a quick lesson in front of your peers, like my peers, my teaching peers, and they just kind of, I'm going to use the word pick apart, but they're just going to say, hey, you know, you lost me at this point. And it's actually preferable to have people who aren't familiar with what you're doing, because they're not going to like fill in those missing pieces that they know how to do.
Naturally. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so you get this and you're like, oh, that's probably going to be a sticking point for my students. And so you can reduce this cognitive load that is going to raise the cost right away. I mean, the instant that they recognize that they feel overwhelmed by something, it's not uncommon for my students to just say, I'm done. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to bother. I'm going to save face right away. Because if I don't try, I really don't look bad. I mean, I can get an F by not doing it, or I can get an F by doing it. And which one's better for me? And so what you can do is small things to kind of improve that. And CLT is kind of the backdrop of that that we start to use.
Well, I think that as I'm kind of thinking through that process, as you're evaluating everything that you do, it's really a high level of planning for what you're going to do. Because if you look at, for let's say maybe just a teacher in a brand new content area, or a teacher who's brand new in the profession, you're really more on a level of what activities am I going to do today, followed by what activities am I going to do tomorrow, and how am I going to keep
day to day,
keep the kids busy throughout the period. When you're actually looking at these decisions that I make, how do they impact the student's approach to the work? How do they impact the student's ability to engage in the work? How do they impact the student's ability to ultimately understand and internalize what we're working on? It's really kind of exciting to me, because it's a much higher level of looking at your teaching. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I mean, you really don't have to be a 25-year veteran to get to that mindset. You probably need at least a couple years to get your core curriculum set, but it's really a way to keep a teacher mentally engaged and not turn into just that kind of rote content machine that cranks out, you know, explanations of content every day.
Yeah. So it turns out that I'm going to pivot on what you said a little bit. I don't know that it's ever been a lot of work. I'm a perfectionist, and that's what actually sinks me. Once I know what I want to teach, it's even the activities are not as significant as like selecting an activity or selecting the best strategy for something becomes less important to me. It's just the idea that whatever I'm going to present, it reduces this burden for them. And so like a personal pet peeve as a student, when I'm, or even as an adult professional in a meeting, when I sit there and we're kind of given a task, and then I know we refer to this as popcorn reading, where you're just calling on random people to do it, but it's popcorn, like, presenters, like someone has gone through and they've done their 15 minutes and they're ready to finish. And then someone else chime in. I also have something to say, and that prompts someone else to stand up and say. And so, I was at a College Credit Plus meeting with my son and some of his friends, and it happened. It just kept happening, and people just kept talking. And so this meeting that was supposed to take 40 minutes ended up taking like 65. And this one student, like my one friend, like it's my son's friend, he just walks out the door going, boy, they circled the drain on that for 25 minutes. and I was thinking the exact same thing. And I'm like, wow, we really punish people on this. And so
staff meetings.
Yeah. And so you walk away like,
no comment.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, Alan. But you walk away and you're like, what am I supposed to take away from this? And there's this cognitive principle of recency and primacy, where you remember the first thing that was said and the last thing that was said, and then all the stuff in between is lost. Mm-hmm. And so do I do that to my students? Do I give them a test and spend the next 15 minutes talking about it, and they lose sight of the thoughts they have in their head where they're ready to go? Or it doesn't even have to be a test. I mean, I'm giving larger projects where they have an idea before they begin, before they even get the thing. And then they see the actual requirements of it. They want to go, and I don't shut up. So,
no, that's a good point. You know, it's funny you're talking about that. And I just thought about one of the math classes we offer, the quantitative reasoning. And the format of that class is when they come in, it's essentially here's a problem, right? And it's not just to solve a math problem. It's like this abstract thought of if you had to feed everybody in Stark County a piece of pizza, how much pizza would you need? Mm-hmm. Right. And it's just meant, and the reason I thought about it is it's just presented and they go. Mm-hmm. And then you see what's designed and then you help refine the thought from there. Right. And so I'm thinking about some of yours, like you said, you give them a project and, you know, you go over it, you keep talking about it, but it almost takes away the opportunity to critically think when we kind of water that down.
Absolutely. Right?
Or their perception on what they can do with it. And then you can refine on a case by case from that point. And so I do, I think we see pockets of this, and I think what you're doing is very cognizant and reflective, but yeah, in general, I can see how that kills creativity in a classroom.
Yeah. If you start getting into the other numbers of it, your attention span is limited. You have a certain number of things you can hold in memory. And then the other thing is if you got to grant our students some credit here. I mean, they are making an effort to do what they're supposed to do in school. And so if you give them a task and their mind starts drifting towards the task and you keep talking, they're programmed to keep paying attention to you. And so you're actually deconstructing the productive things they're doing by doing that. And it's, they're doing it intentionally, but it ends up having a bad effect, which frustrates both you and them. And so it's an interesting dilemma we face. And I guess the message I have there, and it's the one I say to myself, and pardon me, I'm going to swear a little bit, is, you know, sometimes Paul, just shut the hell up.
Yeah. And remind yourself that sometimes, yeah. Like, I think that's the hardest part is you want them to do so well. You want to make sure that you are overly clear mm-hmm. on everything that is expected. And then what you're saying is you're essentially convoluting everything that they're meant to do. And so they leave more confused, not with more clarity.
And they're becoming that way because they're trying to be good students.
Yeah.
Because they're programmed to pay attention to you. And then you end up not giving them anything and diluting their thoughts. So,
you know, it's interesting that's a form of, it fits in with cognitive load, really. Like your directions and instructions can actually continue to add to that cognitive load on a negative way, where you're just putting more information out there that they really don't truly need. And as Alan said, you know, we have good intentions when we do it. We're trying to give them as thorough directions as possible because we know some kids struggle with open-ended things and they want those details, but we don't want to add to that cognitive load so they can just focus on the task at hand and not be distracted.
Yeah. There's a never-ending list of things we can do to kind of both get in the way and help. It's a very fine line between the two. So it's,
yeah, no doubt about that. I have to say that being, you know, this is, I'm in that 25, 26 year range in the profession and having been in many different buildings, two different school districts, those micro teach sessions, I just always so amazed and blown away by the dedication shown in that you'd have a group of teachers, sometimes five, six teachers who would stay mm-hmm. after school. Yep. Go through lessons, provide very detailed critique and feedback, just trying to get better at their profession and their craft. Yeah. And I've worked with a lot of great teachers in different places, but that I've always been impressed by that because I've never come across anything like that other than my time being here. So
yeah, and it's I'm sorry, I'm not going to remember the thing, but it's one of like the high effect size things from Hattie too, and it's very significant. It's not just 0.41. Oh, no. It's above one, I think. So
yeah, it's one of the best adult practices that you can put into place.
Yeah.
Because it's a refinement process.
Right. And I think the really good teachers, even though they may not have an opportunity to get involved with others in something like that, I think the really good teachers kind of go through that process themselves, kind of deconstructing their lessons. The only part that would be missing, obviously, is the feedback from others and the things that you might gloss over or not see. But that's certainly a high-end strategy, and it's really, you know, a type of engineering in a way. I mean, you're trying to engineer and design better lessons, better practices, better mm-hmm. instruction.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing is interesting that I'm finding now is that, you know, obviously we're getting more and more into AI. I've kind of started pressing what AI can do for me more and more and more. And so I haven't fully like investigated this yet, but I hypothesize that if I can't have a peer-to-peer micro-teach, if I threw what I wanted to do out to AI and say, hey, tell me where my gaps are, what's unclear, like what did I not communicate grammatically well, I'm going to get a response back that's going to help me. And it's better than nothing. And it's probably going to take less time than a full-blown micro-teach where you're going to gather a group of people and you don't have to wait as long to do it.
Right. And the social factors that go on, just the conversations, the ideas right. that come yeah. up and things like that.
Yeah, it always rabbit trails off. But it's interesting you say that. One of our teachers here at the high school, talking with them, they started doing something similar to that, you know, creating resource and then asking it to provide areas where they can be clear with direction, mm-hmm. right? And they continue to put it through iterations of that, where eventually they're getting to a point where now when they give the student the work, right, to complete, they're not having to explain it.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's a great way to utilize that resource. Like you said, it's almost having that peer. The only problem is you can't do like a whole run through, right? Yeah. Yet. But allowing them to almost provide those areas where you can add clarity to your yeah. instruction.
And it's interesting too, because I'm still doing some bilingual classes. And so like with programming, it's an interesting thing. I was never a good note taker, partially because I just found it very boring to go back and open up a spiral notebook and try and make sense of what I had done. Maybe if I had better practices, but with programming, I look at it right now and I can't for the life of me justify why I want someone to have a notebook and do all this when this is not an AI thing. It's just the idea that you're going to look at existing code and you're going to take stuff from it and you're going to do it. Meaning if you don't know how to, one of the things I'm teaching right now is how to create a hover effect on a website. So you move your mouse over top of it, it changes from a picture to text. And I really don't care who you are. You're probably not going to remember the lengthy cluster of code you're going to have to insert in multiple places to make that happen. So you're going to have to draw on something. You're going to have to go to a resource to do it. And so back to the CLT thing, like how much task switching am I going to have to do to get to that? Or can I get it from an easy spot? And so that would become kind of the next phase of this that I really am like advocating for, like reduced task switching. And then back to the AI thing, what I started doing was given that I have, well, let me give you some preface to this. Programming predominantly, almost universally, is done in English. So if you're going to use print just to print a simple statement, it's going to be in English. You're not going to have a Spanish translation where the statements, the commands are in Spanish. Mm-hmm. You're going to do it in English and you're going to put Spanish language in there to use it. So you can print a message in Spanish, but print's always going to stay in English. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes very difficult to try and like translate that with the tools that I have. And so I asked AI to generate starter code that had the notes, and it's called a doc string at the top of the thing that I'm doing. And so it basically has an example and it has a couple of like things in there that kind of show people what's going on in this code. And then the first one is completely like worked out, all the code is there for it. And then there's some scaffolded ones, which I would teach along with. And then like the final, it just progresses down this document, which if everything's running and everything's coded correctly, it's all going to execute fine. But by the end, you've got difficult things which you're doing more independently, but they're not task switching to go get the stuff. They're not going on the internet to search for it. They just have to look up on the screen to find examples of it that were recently done. And so it reduces the task switching. And I'm doing bilingual prompts in there to kind of help with that. AI is doing a lot of this for me because it would take me years to generate the work I've done so far this year with what I'm doing. So,
yeah, I think it's really interesting as you're talking about working through some of those coding opportunities with kids and using AI to help create supports for that. And you think about what AI, generative AI, is capable of doing. It's certainly going to change coding, But the one thing that it's not going to replace is there's still going to be a need for someone who has creative ideas of what they're going to generate with that code. And it's not going to replace the need for somebody who understands the code so that they can troubleshoot, so that they can find errors and issues in there. And so it's probably, and you're probably seeing too, that's a little bit of a different dynamic for how students have to approach this as they're learning these skills and they're moving forward compared to what we thought maybe 8 or 10 years ago.
I mean, even 6 months ago, the people I talk to in the industry right now are basically saying on a 2-week cycle, things are changing so fast because AI is getting so much more powerful.
It's crazy to think.
Yeah, it really is. And but it's amazing because I'll see the kids and they'll try. You have kids who are going to be lazy and they'll just have AI generate all of it for them. And they're putting this stuff in their code. And I'm like, wow, that's at least 6 months ahead of where you are right now. And I know you don't comprehend any of this. And so I try to take a kind approach to it, a gentle approach, and be like, okay, so let's see if we can figure out what's happening here and how we can walk this back to something you can and edit. The flip side of that is like, AI can code much better than I can, much faster than I can. It knows more than I can. It's repository of information. Like I can't remember.
Right.
I would consider myself competent at both teaching what I teach and the knowledge of what I'm supposed to teach, at least at the early levels of it. But it's amazing to me, like I'm teaching an HTML and CSS class there are 200, I'm sorry, let me back that up. There are like maybe 70 different HTML tags that we might have to know. That's pushing it, I think, to an extreme. But when you go to CSS, which is what actually formats everything, gives it the style on the page when you're looking at a website, there's like 200 different, I don't know why I'm drawing a blank here on the word, like attributes that you can do. Well, within those attributes, there's something like 800 different values which you can ascribe. Wow. And so I'm surprised every day by the new thing that I learn when I do this. Like I'm not surprised that it exists. It's just, I'm surprised by like, wow, it's just another thing that I kind of felt like I was sort of comfortable on, but there's a whole variety of things that go way beyond this.
Much deeper level. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't care how good I get at this. I'm never going to know all that. If I can use AI to go get me some snippets that I can use and incorporate, that's great. I guess one of the other things with AI, specifically in my world, is like if you're a professional coder, you can't be sending out all of your proprietary stuff onto Copilot or Gemini or whatever.
Open systems, yeah.
Yeah, it becomes part of their large language model and you've just given away your information. So you can get generic stuff, but you're going to have to adapt to what you need.
Yeah, it's really, as you're mentioning, Vic, as this is moving so fast and it really makes you wonder how things are going to continue to adapt and adjust. And I don't know, just to looking at it from my point of view, to kind of nerd out for a minute, it's like makes you wonder if they're going to actually come up against a wall just because like they can't get the data centers and the power fast enough to kind of keep up with all these ideas that people have. And then, you know, the other side of that too, I mean, when you look at it from a more of a corporate or a business structure, at some point they have to start being able to monetize all they're investing in all this hardware and they're not seeing a lot of return on investment yet. And that can't go on indefinitely for all of us in education just to do, you know, have a bunch of fun with free tools. So,
right.
It's going to be an interesting thing. I'd imagine, I mean, right now we're seeing the economy start to struggle a little bit and questions and they're backing down on doing these data centers and how far into the future it's going to be before we have some limits placed on us. I don't know. But at the same time, the things I ask AI to do are pretty low level. I mean, it's generating stuff in 15 to 20 seconds. I'm not having it generate videos, you know, these nefarious ones that people are doing to make it look like someone is whatever. I mean, I had it generate a picture once and I was kind of surprised just because every other experience was so fast. The picture took a minute and it was remarkable in the sense that everything else was almost instant.
Yeah. It's like, I think that $20 a month premium subscription to like, you know, name your AI tool is certainly not covering the amount of compute needed to generate one of these like social media videos of, let's say, some coach standing at the podium saying a bunch of things he would never say
at
a press conference. And, you know, there's tons of those videos in any area that you can think of. So
yeah, absolutely. I don't know. It's an interesting tool. I like it. Again, it's great for what I teach. and I have to embed it in what I do. If you're going to be a coder and you're not going to use AI, you might as well not be a coder right at this point. So
I can see our profession getting to be like that too. Like if you're going to try to teach and you're not going to use the resources that are available, you know, you're not only going to get passed, you might get lapped by others who are. So
Yeah.
I mean, I've told people, I said, if you refuse to engage with AI at this point, you're almost obsolete.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just, they talk, the studies that have been done on the productivity of an individual versus an individual with AI. I mean, it's not even comparable.
No, it's, yeah. I was kind of battling that today because I was trying to work on a program that I want to do for my sophomores in this intro class next quarter. And I want them to have a bit more access to fun things. And so if I had done this, I can clearly figure it out and I can do it. But just fumbling through everything, and I got the first, I don't know, 30 lines done. And I kind of just went to AI and said, hey, this is where I want to go next. Can you give me some, I even specifically said, hey, I don't want you to do it all for me. Can you give me some guidance on what I should do next so that I could do it? And then I did a bunch, and then I probably went back with what the code I had and said, hey, can you critique this for me and tell me where I went wrong? And again, within 3 seconds, it came back and it fixed my code. It was literally like 3 lines that I kind of had a little out of sequence. And I did this iterative thing, and I've generated a pretty fun, it's going to be like an asteroid style game that I'm going to use, that my students are going to kind of build their own out of it. But I guess this goes back to another thought. AI can take our jobs, or we can use AI to become 1,000 times more productive.
Yeah.
And so, I'm trying to use it to become 1,000 times more productive, I guess, is the key.
The person who's really at the, you know, biggest disadvantage is the person who wants to stay exactly the same and not improve or change any of what they're doing.
Yep.
It's, a lot of options out there for us. It's great.
Well, this has been really interesting for me just to see a little bit about how you use some of these theories and some of the other things that you do to really look at improving and always evaluating what you're doing with students. You know, if you were to come across a teacher who was looking for some advice, maybe a new teacher who's struggling, or maybe a teacher who's been in the classroom for quite some time and is just feeling, you know, kind of that point where they're hitting a wall, what advice would you give them just to kind of re-engage or to re-energize them?
So the thing for me that always gets me is, like, if I find myself getting into that sort of distant, like I'm ready for Christmas break kind of mode, I try to think in terms of the golden rule, like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And so it causes me to reflect. And again, how often do I spend time talking over them when they should be given their time to think? Or am I not taking the time to clarify things or reduce task switching or things like that? And so, like, it doesn't take a lot of work to do this. It doesn't take a lot of work to fix it either. It's just one of those things that can have a big effect and sort of bring you back to what you value as an educator. And that's kind of my, I guess that would be my message to anybody. Always reflect and always think in terms of, what did you hate as a student?
It's a student-centered viewpoint. I mean, it really is. And it's kind of interesting as you bring that up. It makes me think about my current role and having the opportunity to do PD sessions for teachers, which I really love to do because it's just another form of planning and presenting information and in some cases teaching. And I sat through so many PD sessions where I just wanted to like gouge my eyes out as a teacher. My goal is every time I put one together to make it so that what I always wanted was something I could take away from it without a lot of extra thought that I could put into practice right away. And, you know, that always guides the things that I do. So, I mean, I can definitely see that reflection on a day-to-day basis with students as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just enough to get people going, let them play. And then the questions are a lot more meaningful when they've had a chance to kind of explore what you've taught.
Yeah. And it's more intentional then.
Yeah. So that is my main message. Beyond that, I mean, if you're just starting exploring this expectancy value cost and CLT, it's amazing how small things can make such a huge impact. It doesn't take a lot. So
small things make a big difference. There's no doubt about that. Well, Paul, this has been great. I've really enjoyed getting to know a little bit more about your background. I've always, always been interested in the things that you've had going on, you know, in your classes downtown, but getting to hear a little bit more about what you've done. This has been interesting. We appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, Paul, not Chad. Chad, it was still good to talk with you again, but Paul, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please remember to subscribe, rate, and write us a review. You can find all episodes of Teaching in Tech with Alan and Chad on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.